Good morning. It's 11:05 a.m. on May 18, 2010, here in New York City for the interview of Yuri Yoshizawa of the Moody's Corporation. This is Brad Bondi, B-O-N-D-I, of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. Would the persons in the room please announce themselves and spell their last name?
Sharon Nellis, N-E-L-L-E-S, from Sullivan and Cromwell. And Matt Sullivan, also of Sullivan and Cromwell, is here with me.
Steve Ross from Akin Gump and R-O-S-S. And I'm accompanied by Megan Greer and Constance O'Connor.
Yuri Yoshizawa, Moody's Investor Service.
Good morning, Ms. Yoshizawa. As I said at the start, we'd be recording this interview, so do you consent to the recording?
Yes.
Okay. A few things before we continue. Because the interview is taped, please wait till I finish a question before answering. That way the transcript is clean. Second of all, because it is taped, please, if you have a response to an answer, please give a verbal response as opposed to nodding your head or or anything of the sort, just a yes, no, or a verbal answer. And lastly, if there's any questions that you have about one of my questions, if you don't understand anything that I've asked you, please stop and ask. Otherwise, I'm going to presume that you understood the question and were able to answer it. As I said at the outset, I'm with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. I'm a staff to the commission. The commission is a bipartisan commission of 10 commissioners set up by Congress in 2009 to investigate the causes of the financial crisis and to do a report for the President and Congress on or before December 15, 2010. In addition, we have some specific statutory requests from Congress, one of which is to look at the role of ratings and rating agencies and what role they may have played in the financial crisis. Because I'm a government agent conducting this inquiry, I'm obligated to tell you that 18 U.S.C. 1001 applies. And that means it makes it a crime to knowingly or willfully provide any false or misleading information to me during the course of this interview. And your lawyers can explain to you exactly what that means and can advise you on that. So while this interview is not under oath, you're still obligated by law to tell the truth. If we could start by telling me your educational background.
I went to Stanford University. I got a bachelor's in a BA in international relations with an economics focus.
And when did you receive your BA?
In 1989.
And do you have any other graduate education?
I do not.
Okay. And were you born here in the United States?
Yes, sir.
Where were you born?
I was born in the Bronx, New York.
Okay. There have been some statement made that English was not your primary language. Is it your primary language or your secondary language?
No, it's my primary language.
It's your primary language. Okay. Your first language was English.
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you. And Ms. Yoshizawa, can you take us through your employment history after graduating from Stanford?
Okay, for two years, I worked as a researcher for the Asahi Shimbun, which is a Japanese daily newspaper,
mm-hmm.
Really just doing basic research for the reporters there. In 1991, I believe, I was hired by Yasuda Trust, which is a Japanese bank, first I was an administrative assistant to the general managers for about 6 months, and then I was trained in their credit program and became a credit analyst looking at corporate credits.
And where were you based?
In New York.
New York.
In about 1994, I believe, I moved to a company called Loan Pricing Corporation, which is currently owned by Reuters, I think. They're a company that looks at the loan market, provides loan information, I was in a group that did credit portfolio analysis for a new credit portfolio consulting for various banks, both in the U.S. and as well as I work with a couple of Japanese banks. And then from 97 to 2000, I worked at PricewaterhouseCoopers in their financial risk management consulting group, doing credit risk consulting as well as economic capital consulting. And then I joined Moody's in 2000.
Okay. And what positions have you held at Moody's since 2000?
I joined as a VP senior analyst in the U.S. derivatives group, mm-hmm. Looking at CDOs. In 2004, I'm sorry, 2003, I was promoted to VP senior credit officer, which is the next level. 2004, I was promoted to team managing director, responsible for a few business lines, the biggest one being synthetics, but also looking at emerging markets, CDOs, TRUP CDOs, muni CDOs. And then 2007, in January, I was promoted to group managing director, responsible for the U.S. U.S. derivatives group. I was co-managing the U.S. derivatives group with Gus Harris at that time. And then in July of 2007, Gus left the group, and so I was the sole manager responsible for U.S. The U.S. derivatives team. And then in September of 2008, I was promoted to senior managing director, and I had responsibility for all the global derivatives groups in New York, London, Paris, Hong Kong, and Tokyo, and I'm still in that position.
When you started Moody's as an analyst, to whom did you report?
I started out reporting to Jeremy Gluck.
And did that change?
Yes. I don't remember exactly what year it changed. I started reporting to Bill May when he got promoted to Team MD. I can't remember when exactly that was. I reported to Bill until I became a managing director, at which point I started reporting to Gus Harris. And then as of January 2007, I started reporting to Noel Kernan. Mm-hmm. And that was until he left in, I think it was July 2008. Mm-hmm. And then I reported directly to Andy Kimball, and I still report to Andy.
When you shared the responsibility of being group managing director with Gus Harris from January to July 2007, mm-hmm. Did you divide up the responsibility of different products?
We did. Officially, we were still jointly responsible for the entire business. He was in a transition phase, going from derivatives to his responsibility overseeing the credit and data, I'm sorry, the model and data products that he's still currently responsible for. His biggest focus was in CLOs, but he did get involved in the other areas. I was responsible, I was also responsible for CLOs. I was also more responsible for the other areas. So we got involved in the other areas. It's just that we had a more primary focus in, for him, CLOs, and I think he was more involved in the DPCs and those construction finance operating companies than I was.
Okay.
But his job was really to kind of transition me into the full way.
You said to transition you was, so when you became group managing director, co-managing director with Gus Harris, there was already a plan for him to exit?
I believe there was, and so it was really his responsibility to kind of get me up to speed on that role.
I see. So at one point you were reporting to Bill May, mm-hmm. another point you were peers with Bill May, mm-hmm. another point you were Above Bill May.
Yes.
What would you say was your characteristics that led to your success in Moody's, your rise through the chain of Moody's?
I can't really say what was in the minds of the people who I reported to in terms of comparing me to others.
If you were giving someone advice, saying, mm-hmm. This is what I think it takes to succeed at Moody's and to go from an analyst through all the way up to a group managing director, mm-hmm. which sounds like you went several levels. Mm-hmm. From 2000, you went from analyst to VP senior credit officer to team managing director to group managing director. To then the sole group managing director and then senior MD. Mm-hmm. Sounds like you've gone pretty high through the hierarchy. If reflecting back, what do you think characteristics helped you to be successful in the corporate ladder mm-hmm. at Moody's?
I think everybody's path is a little bit different. Mm-hmm. If you're asking what advice that I would give to someone. It would be that, in terms of what I feel I've done, is basically speak my mind. I think that the general culture at Moody's is one of discourse, of discussion, and the expectation is that people participate in that. And that you're able to explain what your position is, what your views are, and that you're able to convincingly and add value to a discussion through expressing your views. At the same time, be open to listening to others' views and be open to having your mind changed depending on what the rationale is. I think that's one of the things that we look to is with analysts is whether they understand the transactions, whether they understand the methodology, whether they understand the products, and whether they are able to provide value-added opinions or value-added views on the analysis, on the methodology, on all of that. I think that's one thing. The other is I had exposure to many different types of products, the derivatives area and CDO area is not just one product; it's very much multidisciplinary, and so I think that's another thing that's a plus is for people to have exposure to all the various areas, to have an understanding of both the documentation issues as well as the quantitative issues as well as have a general understanding of what is going on with the various market participants and the transactions. That's kind of the main gist is what we're looking at is do people understand it and are they able to express it well and are they adding value in the discussions?
Now, I understand there are two different types of analysts, a quantitative analyst and a legal analyst. Can you explain the difference between those two?
Tends to have to do with their backgrounds. Although we do have quantitative analysts who are quite well versed in the documentation, as well as legal analysts who are quite well versed in the modeling and quantitative aspects of the transactions. Essentially, everybody is a rating analyst, and so what we're asking people to do, regardless of how they're looking at this, is to provide their assessment of the credit implications of various risks in the transaction. The quantitative analysts are most responsible for any modeling that may have to take place for the transaction. For as the name implies, looking at the quantitative analysis of the transaction. However, they are also responsible for reading the documentation and for understanding the impacts of the transaction to the deal. I mentioned before that probably the best analysts have more of a holistic view of the transaction. So the best quantitative analysts, I think, are those that aren't just ones that know how to run a model. In fact, that's what we don't want. We don't want people who just put numbers in a model and have the output and that's it. We want people who understand the transaction, who understand the implications of certain inputs to the model, the assumptions behind the model, as well as understanding how well the model as it is applies to the transaction itself, whether there's something within the transaction that needs to be considered, whether in the model or outside the model. And so they're asked to do kind of a little bit of everything. The legal analysts tend to have a legal background. I think their main responsibility is to really focus on the documentation. And while we call them legal analysts because of their background, they're not responsible for being counsel on the transactions or to Moody's. They are credit rating analysts. And their main responsibility, as I mentioned, is really the documentation and analysis, which may include legal analysis. It may include just being able to understand how something is worded and pointing out when something may be a little bit more expansive in its definition than not. So it's not just a understanding of the legal issues that may arise in transactions such as bankruptcy, remoteness, or true sale. I think the one thing that we kind of have to focus on with the legal analysts, especially those that are coming to us from law firms, and most often the background for those legal analysts tend to be as lawyers in firms that draft structured finance transactions or that represent parties within structured finance transactions, is that when they do come over to Moody's, they're being asked to just review and to identify risks. And to be able to explain those risks and explain their thinking behind those risks to a rating committee. They are also considered to be analysts on the transaction, so they are being asked to recommend their rating opinion, but they're not being asked to draft or to suggest revisions to drafts. And that's one of the areas that we tend to have to kind of transition lawyers into, is going from being a lawyer to being a credit analyst.
Like you said, they're not meant to draft. Who's drafting? Is it the bank or the lawyers for the bank that's actually structuring the deal, for instance?
Typically, there is a law firm that is contracted. I don't know whether it's the bank that contracts them, or a lot of the CDOs that we rate are managed transactions where there's a collateral manager involved. And I don't know who makes the decision, whether it's the bank or the collateral manager.
But they're not lawyers for Moody's that draft the documents, but lawyers for someone else that's
Correct.
Drafting the documents presented to Moody's.
That's right.
Okay. Help me understand, why is a legal analyst even important? I mean, mm-hmm. if you're running these through models and you have a quantitative analyst, why bother even having a legal analyst?
The thing about CDOs is each transaction is a little bit different. There's not a standard CDO transaction or a standard CDO documentation. So even if you have a type of transaction that has been around for a while, let's say CLOs, you see differences still from deal to deal as the structurers make changes to them. There are differences in terms of structures that are used for various collateral managers and various banks. And so the importance of the documentation is that, I mean, you can run a model, but the model has to represent what is going on in the deal. And the importance of understanding the documentation is the documentation is what governs how the deal works. And so what you're modeling is the information coming from the documentation.
So putting that in sort of layman's terms, the legal side of it, the documentation, could in essence affect the rating.
The documentation, the review of the documentation is part and parcel of the rating analysis. It has to be.
I see. So the inputs into the rating analysis are on a quantitative basis and on a qualitative legal basis?
As well as other, I mean, it's not once again, it has to be a holistic view of the transaction.
Mm-hmm.
And we're looking at all the various risks that can impact our rating, which is essentially can impact a long-term credit view of that transaction.
Okay, great. My goal today is to walk away with an understanding of how ratings work. So I appreciate your patience as I ask you some painstaking questions about the process. But before we get to sort of how the process worked, I wanted you to help me, if you could, identify some names on an org chart here that was produced to us. And my apologies in advance, it was produced to us in a very small, shrunken version.
Mm-hmm.
We've enlarged it, but it doesn't help that much. So I'm hoping that you can just identify the names on here, if you would. And I'm going to go ahead and just, for purposes, since we're probably going to talk about a few documents, just go ahead and mark this as Exhibit 1. Copies for counsel. Ms. Yoshizawa, I'll represent to you that both of these pages are identical. One is just enlarged. The first page is what was produced to us, Moody's FCIC 0005198. And the second page is just an enlarged version of that first page. I'll draw your attention probably to the second page, which hopefully is a little bit better to read, but nevertheless difficult even for my eyes. But can you if you see there's a box at the top, Noel Kernan, I think we talked about him.
Mm-hmm.
This, by the way, is dated July 2005. Mm-hmm. So I believe you said at the time you were a team managing director reporting up to Mr. Harris, who then reported up to Mr. Kernan. And I see that there's, in the box with you, there's two other team managing directors. It looks like Gary Witt and Bill May.
That's right.
Okay. Let's just start with Mr. Witt. Who is Gary Witt?
Gary Witt was a team managing director who was promoted to team managing director at the same time I was in the beginning of 2004. He was responsible for primarily ABS CDOs, and then he also had some areas such as cat bonds, DPCs. I can't remember all the sectors, but I think those were the main areas, market value transactions as well.
And ABS CDOs, is that also known as cash CDOs?
At that time, it was pretty much all cash.
Okay. And and by ABS CDOs, are you including CDOs that had residential mortgage-backed securities as collateral, the underlying collateral?
Yes.
Okay. So Mr. Witt, you said, was in charge of, in July of 05, of that part of the business?
Yes.
Okay. What kind of colleague was Mr. Witt?
I'm not quite sure what.
I mean, professionally, was he an able colleague? Did you respect him professionally? Did he do a good job?
Yes.
Any complaints or reservations about Mr. Witt and his role as a managing director overseeing the ABS CDOs?
No.
And it looks like on the other side, Bill May.
Mm-hmm.
And who was Bill May?
Bill May was also a team managing director. I don't remember the exact year that he was promoted to team managing director. As I mentioned before, I had been reporting to him directly before I got promoted. He was responsible primarily for CBOs and CLOs, and he also, I believe at this point, shared responsibility with Gary for the DPC business. I think those were the main areas. I can't remember what specific other asset classes may have been under him.
You used an acronym, DPC?
Derivative Product Company.
What is a derivative product company?
There's a group of ratings that we assign to what we call structured finance operating companies. Derivative product companies are one of them. So are what's called CDBCs, or credit derivative product companies. These tend to be structured operating companies as opposed to SPVs that are created for a single purpose, such as trading derivatives. A lot of the DPCs trade interest rate derivatives, for example, with counterparties in the market. CDBCs tend to trade credit derivatives with the market. They are, as I mentioned, unlike typical CDOs, they are actual operating companies with boards and governance. But unlike a typical corporation, they're very much restricted in terms of what they can do. That's the structured part of it.
I see. And in July of 2005, what area did you have?
I was responsible for the biggest area was the synthetic CDOs.
Mm-hmm.
I was also responsible for TRUPS, emerging markets, muni-backed CDOs, and when we say synthetics, kind of synthetics that may also go into other transactions, so synthetics that may go into CLOs or CBOs as well as ABS CDOs.
And in July of 2005, what was the synthetic CDO market like for CDOs that were tied or referencing residential mortgage-backed securities?
I would think that it's, I don't remember exactly the timing of when things changed.
Mm-hmm.
But it was still a relatively nascent market. I think we were seeing kind of individual or baskets within cash CDOs where managers were allowed to trade or enter into credit derivatives, but it wasn't necessarily what I would call kind of the hybrid deals that we saw in 2006 and 2007. There may have been a few entirely synthetic deals, but once again, those were still not, I don't think they were the norm yet at this point. I don't remember exactly when that change occurred.
So the synthetic CDO market, and just for purposes of this interview, I'll say when I talk about synthetic CDOs, I'm talking about the kind that are referencing mortgage securities, like residential mortgage-backed securities and the like, or primarily. I know there's all sorts of synthetic CDOs.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, I don't have the bandwidth to understand all of them, and I barely understand synthetics. Mm-hmm. A synthetic's tied to RMBS, so if I refer to a synthetic CDO, please understand that I'm meaning the synthetics that are tied to RMBS. You mentioned that the market was developing at this point in 2005. Did the market subsequently grow, and how quickly of a pace of a growth did the synthetic CDO market undertake?
It did grow. By the end of 2006, I would say the majority of deals backed by RMBS were either 50% or more synthetic. It was something that I think once the I don't remember the exact dates, but once the ISDA templates for CDS backed by various types of ABS, including RMBS, became more standardized, it became something that was widely used.
And what's the practical difference?
Mm-hmm.
Between a cash ABS CDO with underlying RMBS collateral,
mm-hmm.
and a synthetic CDO that's referencing RMBS?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what are some of the practical differences between the two?
Well, the main difference is how the transaction accesses its collateral. The cash transactions typically take the cash raised from the investors in the CDO and uses that cash to buy physical assets, the physical RMBS assets. A synthetic CDO takes the cash, once again, that's raised and invests that into typically some type of highly rated collateral. It could be treasuries. It could be short-term investments. It could be CP. There are many things that they could invest in. And then essentially, and this is, the transaction enters into a credit default swap agreement with a counterparty. Typically, that counterparty is the structuring bank, and accesses the risk exposure, the credit risk exposure to the RMBS through the CDS agreement. In those cases, the CDO or the CDO investors are going long. The counterparty is taking the short side of that trade, the main difference is really that how you access the risk. The intention, I think, of the templates was to mimic as best possible the actual risk and cash flow characteristics of the underlying of the RMBS. I guess the practical implication then for the collateral manager is that, or for the person choosing the assets in the transaction, is that the number of different types of assets that they had access to then increased, because they didn't have to actually buy the physical asset. They could go out and reference transactions from various different vintages, to various issuers, et cetera, without having to buy the actual asset.
And if a cash CDO has to buy all the RMBS, mm-hmm. that process is called warehousing? Buying up the RMBS and putting it all together, is that what the process is called?
The warehousing typically refers to the process of buying up the assets in advance of the CDO actually becoming effective.
And so is a synthetic deal something that a bank can put together, a synthetic CDO, something that a bank can put together quicker than a cash CDO, an ABS cash CDO?
Typically, it is something that could be put together quicker, except for, I mentioned before, there's sometimes collateral managers in deals. In fact, quite often, transactions are managed with a third-party manager that is hired by the CDO to select the assets, as well as to make decisions about trading in and out of the assets over the life of the transaction. The transaction could close without all the assets being selected. So for cash transactions, there's typically what's called a ramp-up period. And so you don't necessarily have to buy all the assets in advance of the deal closing. The analysis that would be done isn't necessarily of the underlying assets, because those could change from day to day, but it's, I mentioned before, the importance of the documentation. The documentation governs the universe of assets that could be purchased and the characteristics of those assets. And so the analysis that's done, the information that's put out there for the deal for us to look at, for investors to look at, et cetera, is really based upon what a manager can and cannot do in the transaction. So you don't have to have a fully ramped up transaction to close. So the speed of getting it to closure doesn't necessarily rely on you having to have all the assets purchased.
And so does the documentation play a more important part in synthetic CDOs than it does in ABS cash CDOs for purposes of rating? I mean, is documentation for your purposes of rating mm-hmm. more important for synthetic CDOs than it is for cash CDOs, because you're relying on references and agreements and referencing other sorts of collateral?
I wouldn't say it's more important. It plays a different role because you wouldn't necessarily have the credit default swap agreements for a cash deal, but the documentation in a cash deal is also very, very important.
And in terms of differences between a cash CDO and a synthetic CDO, all with underlying RMBS either as collateral or tied to RMBS collateral, how does the excess spread differ between a cash CDO and a synthetic CDO?
It depends on the way in which the deal works. It's not necessarily a cash versus synthetic. The cash versus synthetic is merely how you access the risk Mm-hmm. Whether there is excess spread in the transaction or not depends in how you work the cash, the waterfall of payments that come off of the assets. So in a cash deal, you have interest and principal coming off of the cash assets. Those get paid to various noteholders, various stakeholders, fees, etc., by the transaction. And then there is something left at the end of the day. That's could be the excess spread. In a synthetic transaction, you have the premium that's coming from the counterparty, as well as some spread that's coming off of that collateral that I mentioned that you're investing the cash into. And that money also goes through a waterfall. The deal can be structured such that it has excess spread, or it can be structured such that it does not.
Mm-hmm. Did synthetic CDOs generally not have excess spread, though?
Purely synthetic CDOs typically did not have excess spread. Mm-hmm. But those deals that I would characterize as hybrid
deals,
where the collateral could be 100% synthetic, mm-hmm. They typically did have excess spread.
Okay. So where there was excess spread in the synthetics, you're talking about where there were hybrid CDO deals.
Right, and hybrid because the liability side was done in a way that there was some excess spread there.
And to be clear, a pure synthetic deal did not have any excess spread.
A pure synthetic, the way I'm defining it, does not have excess spread.
What about the subordination between a ABS cash CDO and a synthetic CDO? What is the differences generally between an ABS CDO and a synthetic CDO?
Typically, in a cash CDO, not always though. There could be diversion features that will take cash coming off of the assets, whether it's interest or principal, and under certain circumstances, divert that cash to pay certain notes upon certain occurrences. So that could have an impact on the subordination necessary because. If you will, that adds to the subordination for them because in certain circumstances it's further protection for those notes. A typical synthetic deal does not have that type of mechanism in it. However, there are cash deals once again that don't. So to the extent that it's not the difference between a cash and synthetic deal, it's the difference between a transaction that will take additional cash and divert it.
So let me get this straight. A typical cash CDO would have some subordination, and a purely synthetic deal would not have subordination.
No, that's not what I'm saying.
Okay.
Both start off with tranching.
Right.
And so there's always, unless you're at the very bottom of the tranching at the equity, mm-hmm. you'll always have subordination below you.
Right.
A cash transaction that has a cash diversion feature in there basically takes excess spread that would have typically been paid below you mm-hmm. and diverts it to actually pay you, so pay the senior note holder, which kind of adds subordination in a way because it helps to pay back your principal with cash that was not originally going to be paid to you. As I said, a lot of cash transactions have that. Some cash transactions don't. Most synthetic transactions don't have that type of OC trigger, that cash diversion trigger.
So what that translates to, am I correct in saying that typical static synthetic CDO would be closer to the rating hurdles then, as opposed to a cash CDO that had these features for sort of the extra cushion of subordination?
No, the cushion is taken into account in the rating analysis. So it's not that one is closer to the other, it's that the rating analysis for any transaction takes into account the specific features of that transaction. So to the extent a transaction has these cash diversion features, that would be something that we take into account. And so all things being equal, with the same exact collateral in one versus the other of having a diversion versus not having a diversion, is that you would expect to find more subordination for the transaction that does not have more original subordination for those transactions that do not have that diversion feature.
Structured in a way, you're saying. It would be structured in a way to create a, sort of the artificial subordination, extra subordination on the synthetic side?
It's not artificial. It's structured such that it has a certain amount of subordination given the risk on the transaction. The cash diversion feature creates additional subordination over and above the original subordination.
I see.
And so, but the rating analysis takes into account those situations that you would expect to have that diversion and where you would expect to have the additional subordination.
I see. Let's turn back to the org chart here. There are a few names underneath you. Again, if you wouldn't mind just reading them off, if you recognize them. I think the first name's James Brennan.
Yes. Rudy Gunya, Un Choi, Tae Kim, Elena Kolmanovskaya, Jim Leahy, Maria Leopolds, Ben Liu, Kathy Liu, Philip Mack, Ali Madivi, Maria Miyakova, Leon Moganoff, Prashant Paroda, I think that's Min Chu, and Oksana Yaranovska.
Okay. And were the rating, or were these people underneath you, were they essentially analysts?
They're analysts.
Okay. And so did, and as of July of 2005, were these the analysts that worked underneath you? And then the other bucket to the left there are the analysts that worked under Gary Witt, and to the right is the analysts that worked under Bill May?
It's not as discreet as that.
Okay.
The three of us together were responsible for the entire group. There were certain people that reported to each of us from a reporting structure, but because each of us covered various product areas, the analysts who reported to Bill May work, for example, for me or for Gary on transactions that were under us. And so the reporting structure did not necessarily define who we worked with on a daily basis, although we tried to the best of our ability to do that.
How was Gus Harris as a manager?
I don't know what you're...
Professionally. Was he a good manager? Did you view him when you were working and reporting to him?
Mm-hmm.
Did you view him as a good manager? Do you have an opinion about his management by being your effectively your boss?
I didn't have any complaints about him. It was fine.
Mm-hmm. And would Mr. Harris discuss with you when you were a managing director in July 2005, in that time frame,
mm-hmm.
would he discuss with you how the business side was doing of Moody's?
We would have weekly meetings, MD meetings, and it would come up.
And you know, you said weekly MD meetings. This was as of this time frame, July of 2005. It would be you, Gary Witt, Bill May,
and
Gus Harris would meet weekly.
Yes.
And what would you discuss at these weekly meetings?
It could be any number of things from transaction issues that have come up during the week to personnel issues that could come up to information from Gus about what's going on in the rest of the company. It's really anything that can come up in the day-to-day of managing the products.
Would these meetings generally last how long?
They were generally set for an hour, but they could go longer depending on whether there was a lot to discuss or not.
And they were in-person meetings?
Yes.
Would anyone else attend these meetings, like Noel Kernan, for instance?
Sometimes. It wasn't the regular standing members were the four of us. There may be people invited from HR to explain something that may be coming on, or somebody from the IT department to explain some of the changes that they were contemplating. So there would be guests that would come. Noel sometimes would stick his head in if he had something to say to us or if he wanted some information about something.
And would the same be true of Brian Clarkson as well? Would he attend on occasion?
On occasion, he was, once again, same with Noel. They wouldn't necessarily come for a whole meeting. They may stick their head in for some reason or another.
Where would the meetings take place?
Typically in Gus's office.
And I'd asked earlier if he discussed with you the business aspect of the of movies, and you mentioned that he did at these meetings. What sort of business aspects of Moody's did Mr. Harris talk about at these meetings?
Part of it was informative for us to understand what's going on generally at Moody's. We may have had discussions about the P&L of the group, or discussions about the market in terms of what was going on, in terms of whether it's market coverage, or this is what I heard from these other people that I visited and talked to. Business, Moody's business, as well as business end of the industry that we were in.
What do you mean by market coverage? Is that market share?
When we discussed transactions that we've rated, as well as those that we have not rated, deals that in the sense that we're discussing, I mentioned this at the hearing. We're expected as managers to know what's going on in each one of our markets, to understand what deals we've rated, what deals we haven't rated, what deals we were not asked to rate, those that maybe that we had started to rate but were asked not to in the end, and to understand why. Is it because of fees? Is it because there's something different in the way we look at the transaction versus another rating agency maybe looking at it from a credit point of view? Maybe there's something about the way we view some of the documentation issues that others don't, or certain risks. Maybe it's because they need the rating for a certain reason, and so they need they don't need our rating, they need somebody else's rating because of some whatever reason on the part of the investor or the issuer. But we were expected to know why, so that we could understand what's going on in the market.
And how often would these discussions come up?
There wasn't a set agenda for them. It could come up if you read the trades or research that's put out by a bank, and they talk about a transaction that we weren't on. We maybe ask the question, do you know this transaction? Were we asked to rate it? Do you know why we weren't asked to rate it? So it wasn't something that was, let's sit down every whatever number of months and review the list of deals that we were on and were not on and explain, what's going on. The question would be asked every once in a while.
In terms of these weekly meetings, though, when you were a managing director reporting to Gus Harris, mm-hmm. as the group managing director, at these weekly meetings, how often, though, would market coverage or deals lost, how often would these discussions come up? Every meeting, every now and then, 50% of the time on these weekly meetings, once a month?
Every now and then.
Every now and then, once a month, twice a month?
Typically, as it really had more to do with if we found out information because we saw something, as I mentioned, in the research report or trade paper about a transaction that we hadn't rated. So it wasn't so much, let's talk about it every other week or once a month or that type of thing. It was kind of, I saw this, do you know anything about this transaction? I don't remember hearing about it in-house.
And understanding that this may not have been a set periodic event, roughly, though, over your tenure as managing director, mm-hmm. how sporadic would these sorts of discussions come up at the weekly meetings? Would it be once a month, twice a month on average? I mean, can you give us a sense of just how often was this discussed?
I don't remember it being a main part of any meeting, so I know that it came up, but it's not something that I remember as being something that was a regular part of the meetings.
And how often would it come up? Would it come up once a month? I mean, if someone described this as coming up at least once or twice a month, would that be a fair assessment to you, or would that not be a fair assessment to you?
Once a quarter. I mean, if a deal came up that we weren't on, the area that I was responsible for most, the corporate synthetic CDO space, mm-hmm. our market coverage was about, I would say, it was very hard to measure because it was very much a bespoke market, meaning there were a lot of reverse inquiry deals that were done between investors and banks. Mm-hmm. But we would learn that we weren't on deals because a lot of them were done in series. So you'd see each bank had its own branding names for transactions, and you would see series 2005-1, and then the next one you see is 2005-12. So the area that I was responsible for, we were talking about market share that was 20 to 30%. So there wasn't a lot of discussion on a deal-by-deal basis as to why did we miss this deal or why didn't we miss that deal. It was kind of general knowledge that that's kind of what our market share was. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't something that we necessarily talked about often or even as things came up. In the CLO area, for example, our market coverage tended to be a dual-rated market. Our market coverage in that area tended to be close to 100%. So if there was a transaction that we didn't rate, it would be something that would be notable in that you recognize a deal that we were not, so that question may come up. And given that that's the type of market coverage we had, it didn't come up very often. And I would say the same thing on the ABS CDO side as well, that the market coverage was also, I think, in the mid to high 90s, so it didn't come up very often because there weren't that many deals out there that we would see and say, oh, wait, this isn't something that we weren't on. What happened here?
That's funny. I'm very sorry to interrupt, but I think you'll agree with me. I noted in one of the answers that I think you had an inflection that was suggesting you were making your best guess or best estimate, and the record is never going to pick up a tonal inflection. Mm-hmm. So if you are, this is as best as I remember, you need to say that, because we may understand as we're all sitting at the table, mm-hmm. but the tape recorder won't remember tomorrow when it gets typed up.
Mm-hmm. As I mentioned at the start, if there's any indication, obviously don't give any gestures because they don't get picked up on the recorder. So if there's anything that any response that requires an answer, make sure it's a verbal answer.
I think you're talking about how often it came
up.
I don't remember. I don't remember how often it came up. It wasn't so notable that I can mm-hmm. think that it came up quite often. I'm making a pure, I should say it was a pure guess as to what number it was.
Was market share something that you would have known during your course of being managing director, that information that you would have had available to you?
For certain asset classes, yes. For others, no.
Okay. And how would market share be made available to you when you were a managing director?
There were business analysts who reported up to Noel Curtin, whose part of their responsibility was to track the deals in the market through research reports that a lot of the banks publish research reports about the deals in the pipeline and the deals that have been rated. They track those and they compare it to the lists of deals that we've rated. As I mentioned, certain markets are more, there's more information about those markets than others. So for those markets that we did have information, we were able to see what the deals were that we weren't on. For those that weren't as transparent, like synthetic markets, we did not know.
When you were managing director in 2005, how were you compensated?
We were paid there are two different. There are two different, payment programs, compensation programs. The analysts are under what they call PIP. The managing directors are under EPIC. Under EPIC, we receive a base salary plus we are given what's called a bonus target, which is essentially a number against which a multiple is applied to determine what the bonus amount is, and then there's some portion that is options and another portion that's restricted stock. The multiple on the bonus is based upon, was based upon at this time, the overall performance of the company to some extent, and then I believe to a slightly smaller, I think, I don't remember the exact split, 55-45, I believe is the number. I think 45 is on how the line of business performs. But it's relative to a growth target of 12.5%. And so depending on how, what percentage the company grows over the 12.5%, that determines what the multiple is.
Okay. So let me get this straight. You had a cash salary in 2005 when you were managing director.
Mm-hmm.
You had a bonus.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had some sort of equity compensation as well?
Yes.
Okay. The equity obviously would be tied to the performance of the company. Is that?
I don't know how the equity is.
And the cash bonus part, mm-hmm. the cash bonus component, you talked about 55-45.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you were talking about? 55% of the cash bonus would be based on how the overall company did, and 45% would be how your particular group would do? Did I get that right?
Right, but the overall funding for the EPIC program was based upon how well the company did relative to a 12.5% growth target.
So the company had a growth level, growth target. And that would be set at the beginning of the year, or do you know?
For EPIC, I think it was static. I think it was 12.5.
Okay. And did your group have a target that would also be set at the beginning of the year?
Yep.
Okay. What was the component that was based on how well your group did?
Mm-hmm.
How was that derived?
I actually don't know.
Was that based on market coverage? Do you know?
I don't know at all.
At the beginning of each performance review period, mm-hmm. Would you have targets that would either be set by you or set by someone else?
For?
Performance targets.
We had goals for the year that we were supposed to work through with our boss in terms of determining what those, to put down what those goals were and then review those at the end of the year.
And in 2005, what were the categories of goals that you would have had?
There were specific categories on the managing director performance evaluation, and I can't remember what those were. They've changed since then.
In 2005, or at any point when you were mm-hmm. managing director, was market coverage part of your performance target?
Market coverage, for the sake of market coverage, was never a performance target.
What about market coverage in any way?
The expectation of us was that we would be able to rate those transactions that we felt comfortable rating, and that, meaning we as a group, we as committees, as Moody's. So to the extent that, for example, my area with synthetics, we had a relatively low market share. To the extent that it was because of credit enhancement levels that we felt comfortable with the enhancement levels and the models that we were using to derive them, that if that was what was determining the market coverage, we weren't expected to grow our market coverage by changing our methodology or changing our models to get there.
So was market coverage, though, in any way
mm-hmm.
part of your compensation when you were a managing director?
My understanding is that we were expected to meet, as I mentioned, that goal of rating what we could rate and what we felt comfortable rating. My compensation was not tied to increasing market coverage or even maintaining market coverage if that meant that we would need to compromise our credit standards. So I did not feel that my job was dependent on market coverage.
I'm trying to figure out if that was a yes or a no. Is was your compensation as managing director in any way, not what you expected or what you thought that meant in terms of what you're supposed to do, but was your compensation as managing director in any way tied to market coverage?
Just let me see if I understand the question, because you had started with a series of questions talking about the goals that had been set at the beginning of the year. Is your question now still, was it a goal, or did I hear your question being that not in terms of expectations?
I'm just starting off generally. Generally, was your compensation in any way based on market coverage? I mean, and I understand that you didn't think that there were additional expectations put on you and the like, but just as a absolute understanding, was market coverage any component of your compensation?
My understanding is that it was not.
Not any component, okay. And going back to the goal part, was market coverage part of, in any way, the goals that were set or laid out by you in conversations with Mr. Harris at the beginning of the period?
When you say, was market coverage any part of any goal, I mean, there were no market coverage targets that we were expected to meet. Was it part of the goal of rating what we could rate because we felt that it was something that was within our approach and our where we felt that we could rate those transactions because of our methodology, because of whatever the case is? Were we expected to rate as much of that as we could? Yes.
And would there be a percentage discussed at the start of a year when you were laying out your goals with Mr. Harris? Would there be a discussion of, I think we can only probably rate 25% of the market as compared to last year? Or would there be those sorts of discussions where you would talk about what are the deals that you think you can actually rate for the next period?
Not a percentage. Once again, we didn't know what our market coverage was in the U.S. In the corporate synthetic market. We had a sense, and so we didn't have knowledge of what the market coverage was, other than through anecdotal information, and as I mentioned, through the series numbers on certain types of transactions. And so there was no goals based upon those numbers because there were no numbers.
Was there discussions with Mr. Harris during your tenure as a managing director about increasing your market coverage?
There were discussions about why we thought our market coverage was low in that area. There were discussions about what we can do we felt that if we could communicate to the market what our views were, that there would be those investors, those parts of the market that, despite the fact that our enhancement levels may be higher, would still want our rating because we provided a certain type of analysis, or we basically explained this is why our enhancement levels need to be higher in order to get the same ratings. So the hope was that we could, by putting that information into the market, that we could increase the number of deals that we were rating. So the discussion was about what can we do to get our information out there that could lead to us rating more deals.
And did conversations also center, when you were a managing director, around efforts that you could make to reach out to investment banks and issuers in terms of obtaining more business from the investment banks and the issuers?
We were in constant communication with the market, including investors as well as investment banks, issuers, collateral managers, but not for the purpose of soliciting transactions, if that's what you mean. The discussions would be more along the lines of, what are you seeing in the market? What are your expectations for this year? What should we expect from you in terms of the transactions that you plan to bring to us? So that type of conversation. But it wasn't of the type of, please let us rate your deals.
And your conversations, though, with Mr. Harris, mm-hmm. would you ever have any conversations with him about any particular banks that weren't going to Moody's for ratings?
I can't remember if we had that conversation.
And did you have any conversations about Mr. Harris with Mr. Harris about any sort of business development as a managing director? When you were managing director, did you have conversations with him about business development?
As I mentioned, the main type of discussion was about what can we do to get our information out in order to potentially not just get the information out there, but in order to potentially increase the number of deals that we may be asked to rate.
Okay.
But that's the only type of, it's not like we had a discussion about how do we increase our coverage, or what are the goals, that type of thing.
Okay. And what sort of conversations when you were managing director did you have with Mr. Harris about getting asked to rate more deals and that sort of, I think you said, get our information out there.
Mm-hmm.
What sort of conversations did you have with them about that, about how going about to do that, to have more people ask you to rate deals? How did you go about doing that?
We talked about publication plans. We talked about speaking at conferences.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about investor briefings. Those were the main routes that we used to communicate.
And during your tenure as a managing director, you mentioned investors and investor briefings.
Mm-hmm.
What investors do you remember you personally speaking with when you were team MD?
You mean what specific
mm-hmm.
investors?
What specific investors did you personally have conversations with?
We received calls and had meetings all the time. I'm not sure.
Okay. And let's just take the meetings then.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Who do you remember when you were a managing director
mm-hmm.
having meetings with? What investors do you remember having meetings with?
We had meetings with pretty much all the monolines. We had meetings with various insurance companies, Japanese banks, other German banks, people from pension funds. It was just a mixture of a lot of different parties. Also, a lot of the investors in CDOs across the various CDOs are also collateral managers. And so we would have meetings all the time with the collateral managers.
Do you ever meet with any community banks?
I don't recall meeting with any.
Okay. Did you ever have any meetings with any credit unions?
We may have, but not. I don't think it was as an investor. I think it was because they were interested in actually doing a CDO.
Okay. And what credit union was that?
It was one from Australia. I don't remember the actual name.
Okay. And did you have any meetings when you were team MD with any pension funds?
I think we may have. I don't remember the specific meetings.
Do you remember any pension funds, though, that you met with? not the content of the specific meeting, but you remember buying out with that pension fund at some point. I don't remember what we talked about, but do you remember any pension funds that you met with?
We may have met with teachers. That's the only one that I could think of off the top of my head that is a pension fund.
TIA, correct?
Yeah. And also a manager. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Bobby, when you have a second, I need a 2-minute break.
Why don't we take a 2-minute break?
Thank you.
We're going off record. It's 12:15. It's 12:22. We're back on record. That wasn't for you. I was just trying to move it this side. You already have one.
I have one.
Ms. Yoshizawa, I'm going to show you what I'm marking here is Exhibit 2, and I'll collect from you all these exhibits at the end. I have copies. It's another org chart that was produced to us, and unfortunately it's small, so the second page is the org chart enlarged a tad, so I'll...
That's the concordance.
Even enlarged, it's not very clear, though. That's the... problem. Ms. Yoshizawa, I'm showing you what's marked as Exhibit 2. It's Moody's FCIC 0005186, and it is the second page of this document is just the first page enlarged, so if we could turn to the second page it might be easier to read. The date of this is August of 2007, and it's an org chart with for the derivatives of Americas. And in August 2007, you were the group managing director, correct?
That's correct.
And you reported to Noel Kernan?
That's right.
And I notice underneath you on this org chart are some additional names, and I don't believe we've talked about all of them. We've already talked about Bill May, mm-hmm. who was your former colleague when you were a team MD, correct? Eric Kolchinski, mm-hmm. Yvonne Fu, and Jonathan Polanski. First of all, what was generally Mr. May's responsibilities in around 2007? At the time this org chart, or leading up to this org chart, what was he in charge of?
His responsibilities really didn't change too much from the previous org chart. He was still responsible primarily for CBOs and CLOs, including SME CBOs, which are also part of his purview in July of 2005 as well.
And forgive me, you used some acronyms there. You said, I think, CBOs.
Collateralized bond obligations, collateralized loan obligations, and small and medium enterprise collateralized loan obligations.
Eric Kolchinski, what were his responsibilities?
He's responsible for ABS CDS, generally including both cash and synthetic and hybrid. So all types of ABS CDS.
All types of ABS CDO deals.
Right, and he also took on, I believe, the muni sector.
Yvonne Fu.
Yvonne Fu had been an MD actually between. Somewhere between July of 2005 and August of 2007, she had already been promoted, so she had been existing MD when I took responsibility, so we had been colleagues before this. She was responsible, I believe she, along with Bill May, was co-lead on the SFOCs, the Structured Finance Operating Companies. She took on the market value transactions, and she later... I don't remember exactly when it happened. It may have been already at this point. She also helped Eric with ABS CDOs, including CDO Square.
Jonathan Polanski?
John was responsible for corporate synthetics and surveillance, generally across all sectors.
I'm sorry, what was synthetics you said?
Corporate synthetics.
Corporate synthetics. Okay. And did he have any role in ABS CDOs or any CDOs that were tied to RMBS?
Yes, he was responsible for surveillance across all
sectors. I see. And it looks like underneath him is John Park.
That's right.
Who is he?
He was the senior analyst responsible for the surveillance function.
Okay. And when was the surveillance group for CDOs started?
I believe it was sometime in 2003, 2004, that time frame.
And was it always a standalone group like this, or was it integrated into the various managing directors?
When it was first set up in 2003, 2004, I believe it was done with John Park as co-lead, and at that time John Polanski was also part of the group as another senior analyst, and I think it was a standalone group reporting up to Gus Harris. I'm not absolutely sure of that, but that's my recollection.
Okay. There are two names off to the side that look to be reporting to you on the diagram in the box in the far right. Can you read those names for me, please?
Should be Rudy Punya and An Choi, but that doesn't look like that. It should have been Rudy Bunyan and An Choi. I'm not.
Okay.
It's just that the print is unclear.
And what did they do?
Essentially, prior to this, when Gus and I co-ran, one of them reported to me, and the other reported to Gus. They were really senior analysts whose responsibility was to look across the various asset classes. So you had MDs who were responsible for individual asset classes. And these were two analysts that had strong knowledge across the various asset classes, and we were asking them to kind of be involved across, so that we'd make sure that we were being consistent where we needed to be across the spectrum.
Taking the four managing directors, Mr. May, Mr. Kolchinsky, Ms. Fu, and Mr. Polanski. Mm-hmm. Roughly, what was the breakdown in revenue generated underneath those four individuals?
I have no idea. It wasn't something that we looked at.
Okay. You have no sense in terms of which of the four managing directors was generating the most revenue?
I know that the CLO and ABS CDO areas were generating the most, but it was not something that was a report, or I don't know what the amounts were, nor did I know it at the time.
What about number of deals? Who was rating, of the four managing directors there, what groups were rating the most deals?
Well, you also have to remember the surveillance was covering a large number of deals as well as having a revenue line. So, you know, there was definitely revenue in that sense as well. The ABS CDO area was quite busy especially in the first part of 2007, which is why we divided it between Eric and Yvonne eventually. And then CLOs were quite active as well. So I don't know what the breakdowns are in terms of numbers. Corporate synthetics tended to be small deals, but quite plentiful. So I don't know what the deal number breakdown is.
Per MD. Okay. But at some point you said the ABS CDOs got so busy that some of them were taken away from Mr. Kolchinsky and given to Ms. Fu. Is that fair?
Eric asked for help.
Okay. Asked for help because there were so many deals?
Eric asked for help, and Yvonne had been the MD prior to Eric. Responsible for, for ABS CDO. She took over from Gary Witt. Mm-hmm.
And was this a situation of the number of deals or the complexity of deals? Why did Mr. Kolchinsky need help?
He asked for help because of the number of deals. Mm-hmm.
And did you feel like that was a valid request?
Yes.
And when did he ask for help?
As I said, I don't remember the exact month. I think it was during the first half of 07, but I don't remember exactly when.
How long did Mr. Kolchinsky report to you?
from January 2007.
Okay. Prior to that, were you peers?
No. He was promoted to Team MD at the same time that I was promoted to GMD.
Did you interact with him prior to January 2007 professionally?
Yes.
Okay. How would you interact with him?
Each one of the MDs had a couple of senior analysts who we relied on as called team leaders, who are kind of the methodological and product experts in the various areas. Eric was Yvonne's team leader in ABS CDOs. As the synthetic and cash markets became more and more, as they came together more, at that time, Yvonne and I, and prior to that, Gary and I, started working together more and more on the ABS CDO area, and so our team leaders also did that. The team leaders who had reported to me in this area were Rudy and Un, as well as a few others. In the end, there were a large number of team leaders, Pooja Barwani, Steve Leocci, Take Him, all of whom got involved in ABS CDOs just because of for a number of deals. So, as I mentioned before, it's not a discrete reporting versus deal relationship. So people who reported to Yvonne, for example, also worked with me. And so Eric, as one of the team leaders in the overall ABS sector, worked with me on the ABS CDOs that I would assign and I would be responsible for.
And prior to you becoming group managing director, mm-hmm. In January of 2007, mm-hmm. I just wonder if I could just ask at some point counsel to tell me how to enlarge these so I can get them in a readable fashion, or perhaps easier, if you could just send me these in a more readable fashion, that would be great.
I'll send you a copy that's readable. It's important. It lets you blow it up on screen, but not print.
Here, Chazelle, I'm showing you what will mark as Exhibit 3. And again, if I could collect these back from you at the end so we have copies here. Here, Chazelle, I'm showing you what's been marked as Exhibit 3, and I'll hand you as well an attachment, or attachments rather, that went with this email. Excuse me. I'll represent that these attachments accompanied the email here, and I'll also represent that apparently there was a correction in one of the attachments, and so that's why the first quarter of 2007, I believe, is twice on here. But we can sort this out at some point. But here is first quarter of 2007, or these might actually be one document. Attachment for the first quarter of 2007, and then the first quarter of 2007, and then, as I mentioned, there was, for some reason or another, two first quarter. I don't know if they're one was a correction or not. We're not going to get into the accuracy of which one's the more recent one I'll represent. I don't know which one is the more updated one, and I can represent that. And then here is the second quarter, which was also an attachment to this email. So we'll just put these together with Exhibit 3. Ms. Yoshizawa, looking first to the email here, that let's take to first the email on the second page from Ivy Lam, mm-hmm. dated July 5th, 2007, 6:25 p.m. To Jonathan Polanski, Eric Kolchinski, Yvonne Fu, Bill May, copying you and copying Sunil Sarana. Mm-hmm. Is that the correct? First, just identifying persons. I think you referred to Ms. Lam earlier, but who was she again?
Both Ivy Lam and Sunil Sarana were business analysts, reporting to Neil Kane.
Okay. And they sent an email here on July 5th, 2007, to Mr. Polanski, Mr. Kolchinski, Ms. Fu, and Mr. May. Mm-hmm. Those were all your managing directors, correct?
That's correct.
And they copied you, correct?
That's right.
Why are they sending it to the... why is Ms. Lam sending this information to your managing directors? The subject of the email, by the way, is 2Q Market Coverage CDO. Why was Ms. Lam sending market coverage information to your four managing directors?
Typically, the information would be sent to the managing directors for a couple of reasons. One is it's interesting information for them because it's not something that they would necessarily have, so that they can see if there was a transaction that they were not on, so that they can ask questions if they want to. And secondly, it's to see if the information that's being collected is accurate to the best of our knowledge.
And were these emails typical?
I know that I did receive them every once in a while.
At least once a quarter.
I'm assuming once a quarter. I don't recall whether we did or not.
I'll represent that we've seen these at least once a quarter.
Okay.
Does that sound about right to you? That
yeah, I think there was a period of time where that was happening. I don't know that it was for the entire time that I was an MD or as a group MD.
Okay. And you respond to the email saying, Ivy, Sunil, looks like the markets deal column may have the total deal size, including the equity of the CDOs, which causes us to underestimate market share on a dollar basis.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll represent to you that that's why there's two first quarter mm-hmm. sheets, because along the course of this email chain, two sheets, mm-hmm. A corrected sheet was sent. Just looking at these sheets for the first quarter of 2007, can you tell by looking at these which one's the corrected sheet? So we at least figure that one out.
You're looking at...
the first quarter of 2007, there's two of them. One of them was a corrected version, and I was just asking Ms. Yoshizawa if she could tell which one was the corrected version just by looking at it. And if you don't know, that's fair, but it appears that you've pointed out an error in the first column or the first version of these.
The first, I just want to make sure I understand. You're asking for comparison between the two that are labeled?
First quarter 2007. Was one a corrected version?
Can we go off the record for 1 second? It doesn't have to be off the record.
Okay, go ahead.
Just looking at it quickly,
mm-hmm.
one of the ones that's labeled first quarter mm-hmm. and the upper corner appears to be
second half, perhaps.
The same list as the one labeled second quarter.
Oh, I see.
And I'm wondering if the correction, one of the corrections, is perhaps just the label, and rather than spend a long time, which I could see us doing.
Appreciate that. Okay. I was just wondering why there was a correction. I don't want to get into specifics. I was just trying to figure out, for my sake, why there were two. I appreciate that, and I think you're correct, because it appears that that these may have been mislabeled at some point.
I can't tell by looking this quickly.
No problem. Why don't we move on here? You respond, though, to point out that there was apparently a problem in this spreadsheet. There's some series of exchanges between you and first Ms. Lamb, and then is it Mr. or Ms. Serrano?
Mr.
Serrano. It was important to you, though, to get the figures correct. Is that fair?
Yes. Okay.
Why was it important to actually have the figures correct?
Because this is information that's for reporting purposes. I was asking what the reason was for the for that. If as I'm saying, if we're looking at market share, we should be looking at our share of the market that we could be asked to rate. So I was just saying that, you know, if that's what we're trying to accomplish here, then I don't think that we're doing it with the way in which it's presented.
And let me ask you about some of the information that's on the spreadsheets generally, if you could help me. First has a deal ID.
Mm-hmm.
What is that, like a CUSIP number?
I don't think this is CUSIP. This is internal Moody's ID.
Okay. And then it has the deal name.
That's right.
Right. Closing date, that's when the deal closed.
Mm-hmm.
Moody's deal size, what does that tell you?
It's the size of the deal that Moody's rated.
What do you mean by that? What is the size of the deal?
It's the dollar amount of the tranches that Moody's rated for each deal.
I see. So if we take, just for purposes of illustration, the sheet that has first quarter 2007 goodness, these sheets look a little off. The sheet that says at the top, ECO 2007-1 SPC, just for illustrative purposes, when it has Moody's deal size 162, is that 162 million?
Yes.
And that's 162 million of that transaction was rated by Moody's.
That's right.
Okay. And then it has S&P deal size 162 million as well?
That's right.
Okay. And then it has Fitch deal size nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And it says market deals 162 million.
Mm-hmm.
So does this tell you that you rated 100% of the deal?
100% of the rated part of the deal.
I see. 100% of the rated part of the deal. And S&P also rated 100% of the rated deal.
Right. I don't know whether the last column was just them taking the maximum number, or
mm-hmm.
whether they got that information independently.
I see.
So if both Moody's and S&P only rated a certain portion, or there was information that was missing in terms of S&P or Fitch, I don't know if they went out and confirmed that 162 million of this transaction was rated,
mm-hmm.
Or whether they just said, we'll just take the maximum of the two. I mean, there may be occasion here where one is, the number is larger, but I'm not sure.
Okay. Looking through these spreadsheets, it appears that Moody's and S&P are generally rating almost every deal, with Fitch rating only a few.
Mm-hmm.
Was that the norm, that S&P and Moody's generally rated the CDOs?
For the cash CDOs, with cash or hybrid CDOs, yes.
Mm-hmm. And was there any indication of what types of cash CDO deals that Fitch was able to rate? Why Fitch was only on a few deals and what the characteristics of those deals would have been? Did you have a sense in terms of what deals Fitch was getting versus what deals you were getting?
Yeah.
If you look on the second attachment, which is also unfortunately labeled first quarter of 2007, mm-hmm. there's some highlights.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. For instance, take the first page. Silvercrest Loan Fund 2007-1 is mm-hmm. highlighted. Do you know why that was highlighted?
I don't know.
And if you flip to the second page, there's Bryn Mawr 2 highlighted. LCM Limited Partners 7 highlighted. Hudson Canyon Funding 2007-1 highlighted. And PPM Rivera Loan Fund 2007-1 highlighted. And if you flip to the third page, it's also AMP SSS 2007-4 highlighted.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know why these deals were highlighted?
I don't know who highlighted them. I don't know why they're highlighted.
Okay. And if you notice, each of the deals that are highlighted are deals that Moody's appears, at least according to this spreadsheet, of not participating in rating. Is that a fair assessment from your review of this?
Yes.
Okay. Was that significant if Moody's was not involved in rating the deal?
I don't know if I would characterize it as significant. Once again, we were expected to know what deals we were on and what deals we were not, and why.
And if you were not on a deal, mm-hmm. for instance, the Silvercrest Loan Funding 2007 deal, mm-hmm. that according to the spreadsheet, Moody's didn't rate,
mm-hmm.
what would you do as the team MD? Would you follow up with persons to ask them why this deal wasn't rated?
As a team MD, there could be a reason why I know already. If it's a certain type of deal that we've heard about in the market. So I may not have to necessarily ask. If it's a deal that I had not heard about, I may look at either. I would ask them where they got the business analyst, where they got the information, and I may look to see what it says in that publication where they got the information. Or I could also call the find out who the bank is, or find out who the manager is, to find out what the reason was that we weren't asked to rate it.
And to follow up on the deals that you weren't rated, was that something that Noel Kernan, your boss, expected you to do?
No, it was every once in a while we would be asked, and when we were asked, we would make the call. As I mentioned, it may also be something that as a manager or as a somebody who's responsible for an area that, when we get this, we may look through it and say, I hadn't heard about this. Personally, I'd like to know why we weren't on it. But it wasn't the case where we would get this on a quarterly basis and be expected to provide an answer every quarter as to why we were not on certain deals that were either highlighted or that were shown that we're not on.
Did you ever have any conversations when you were team MD mm-hmm. with Noel Kernan about any of the deals that Moody's did not rate?
As a team MD?
Mm-hmm. No, I'm sorry, as a group MD. When you were group MD, mm-hmm. did you ever have any conversations with Mr. Kernan about any of the deals that you didn't rate? The deals that you lost?
I can't remember a specific conversation, but I can't remember a specific conversation. I'd be surprised if it hadn't come up at some point.
So wouldn't it be unusual for you to have had conversations with Mr. Kernan about deals that you didn't rate?
It wasn't something that happened often, but as I said, we were asked every once in a while if there were certain deals and what would happen with those deals. That question could come from Noel, it could come from Brian, it could come from any number of sources. And so it may be something that either I mentioned to him that we observed the trend of this type of deal not being rated by us and providing an explanation to him for why that is the case. Or it could be that I'm being asked to look into it, and I get back and let them know.
And did you do you remember or recall having any conversations with Mr. Clarkson about deals that you lost to competitors?
No.
None with Mr. Clarkson?
I don't remember any deal-specific conversations, though.
Okay, what about, did you have any conversations with Mr. Clarkson about losing deals to any of your competitors?
Not about losing deals. I mentioned before that the synthetic area was one where we didn't have market coverage, so it was something that that we did discuss, and I explained to him why that was the case.
Did Mr. Clarkson ever express, either in form or in substance, that if you lose a deal and you're not able to explain why, your job was in jeopardy?
No.
Mr. Clarkson never did that?
No.
Did Mr. Kernan ever say that, in form or substance, that if you lose a deal and you can't explain why, your job is in jeopardy?
No.
Did you believe that to be the case?
That my job was in jeopardy?
No. Did you believe that if a person, either you or one of your MDs underneath you or an analyst, lost a deal to a competitor, wasn't able to rate a deal, for whatever reason, and they weren't able to explain why, that their job could be in jeopardy?
No, they were quite often, we wouldn't be able to explain why.
Yeah. Now, I'll represent that we've spoken to quite a few employees at Moody's who have expressed the belief that if they lost a deal, in other words, if they weren't able to rate a deal, they felt that if they weren't able to articulate a satisfactory reason why, that their job potentially could be at stake. Do you believe then that perception that they had was an inaccurate perception?
I don't know what other people's feelings were or views were. I'm telling you that I did not feel that.
So their perception would have been inaccurate, you're saying? If they believed that, that would have been an inaccurate perception on their part.
It's my understanding that our jobs were not in danger if we could not explain why we were not on a deal. And as I mentioned before, there were quite a few where I could not explain why we were not on a deal.
Do you have any understanding of why someone would believe that, that their job could be in jeopardy if they lost a deal? Do you have any sense of what would make someone have that belief?
I can't speak to why somebody would have a perception based on, I don't know what their experiences are. I don't know what their interactions with people are. I can only say that my interactions with my bosses, including Gus and Noel and Brian, did not lead me to feel that my job was ever in danger if I could not explain why I could not rate a deal.
What about your interactions with your managing directors?
Mm-hmm.
Would you talk to them about any deals that they lost?
I don't think of it as we lost a deal or that they lost a deal. There were deals that we did not rate. There were deals that we that may never have been brought to us. There were deals that we've talked about in proposal stages where we made the decision that either we could not rate it or that we let the structure know that the rating that we thought that we could come to was something lower than what they expected. I would have discussions with my MDs, as I did with my bosses, on all those type of cases.
Okay. I'll show you what we'll mark as Exhibit 4. PSI-Moody's-MS number 1. It's Exhibit 24A from the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations exhibit book that they released to the public. Have you seen this email before?
I have.
At the bottom of the email, Ivy Lam is attaching in October 2007 the third quarter market coverage for CDOs. Sunil follows up with an email to you. Market share by deal dropped to 94%, though by volume it's 97%. It's lower than the 98 plus percent in prior quarters. Any reason for concern? Are issuers being more selective to control cost? Is Fitch cheaper, or is it an aberration? So now, what did you understand, Mr. Serrano, to be asking you here?
He was asking whether there were to look at the sheet and to provide explanation if we knew as to why the number of deals that we had rated had gone down.
And you follow up with his email and you send an email to your four managing directors that same day, October 5th, 2007, right? And you say, can you please take a look at the deals that we didn't rate from the spreadsheet that Ivy sent out last night to double check the information and to let me know of any stories. And you have stories in quotation marks. Thank you. What do you mean by stories, and why did you put it in quotations?
Stories meaning why we... Is there reasons for why we didn't rate the deals? So is there something that's interesting to know? Is there... Do we know what the... Really, what the story is behind any of these transactions that we did not rate?
And Ms. Fu responds, no story from my side, but I noticed that there are three Fitch deals, only deals with less than $100 million notional per deal. Mm-hmm. They obviously would not contribute much to the dollar-based market share, but they contributed to about 3% of the deal percent market share.
Mm-hmm.
What was Ms. Fu saying there? Can you explain
that? She was saying that, yes, by deal count, it does seem that the share of the market has dropped, but these are small deals. She's essentially doing an analysis of the data to say, the reason why the deal count number seems to drop more than the volume number is because these tend to be smaller deals that we were not on.
And I'll show you another email that was not in the PSI, but we have obtained.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll mark this Exhibit 5, which is a continuation of the chain.
Mm-hmm.
An email from Jonathan Polanski to Yvonne Fu, yourself, Eric Kolchinski, Bill May, copying Ivy Lam and Sunil Serrano, dated October 5th, 2007, 12:59 p.m. And Mr. Polanski just says nothing additional to add.
Mm-hmm.
What was happening in the market in October of 2007 for CDOs?
The number, there were many different types of CDOs. I think the number of ABS CDOs obviously came down overall in the market. We were still seeing, I think, quite a few CLOs. I don't remember specifically any specific changes on synthetic CDOs, synthetic corporate CDOs. That was basically what we were seeing.
What was the market like in November of 2007?
I don't remember when. I mean, I know that at some point we stopped seeing deals in various areas, but I don't know which month and when that happened.
By the end of 2007, you weren't seeing hardly any CDOs. Is that fair?
Like I said, I don't know when the CLOs started coming off.
This says market coverage CDOs. By the end of 2007,
CDOs include CLOs.
Okay. By the end of 2007, mm-hmm. the ABS CDO market had dried up. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, mm-hmm. even before that.
Even before that?
Yes.
When did it dry up?
I think the third quarter.
Third quarter?
Mm-hmm.
And this is the third quarter coverage here.
Mm-hmm.
Is that fair?
Yes.
And you were worried about market share, at least on October 5th, 2007. Is that fair?
We were concerned of the deals that were in the market. What were we rating? What were we seeing? Why were we not on the transactions? The transactions that are being pointed out here and here are not ABS CEO transactions. These are loan transactions. So it doesn't matter what kind of CEO. We're trying to understand what's going on in the market and what kind of deals are being done and what deals we are on and what deals we're not on.
What happened the week after you sent this email?
I don't know.
Did anything significant happen with respect to CDOs the week after you sent this email on October 5th, 2007? What happened the next week?
I don't know what you're referring to.
If you recall that Moody's had announced quite a number of downgrades the following week.
Yes.
Were you aware that the downgrades were coming when you sent this email on October 5th, 2007?
Yes, because we had been doing analysis, we'd been doing deal surveillance.
And did it ever strike you as odd or unusual that you would be talking about a drop in market share at a time when the market was so I'll withdraw that. Did it strike you as unusual for you to be talking about market share the week prior to when you were going to announce a number of downgrades? In fact, I believe in October it was to date the most number of downgrades announced at any one time for Moody's. Did it strike you as odd that you're talking about market share just the week prior to when you were planning to announce a number of downgrades on RMBS and on CDOs?
You seem to be indicating that or asking about market share has to do with us thinking that we should be on certain deals and asking the question as to why, from the point of view of how could you not be on these deals? That's not the way we view these reports. We view them as information that was being provided to us about what was going on in the market. It covered all types of transactions except for the corporate synthetics because, as I mentioned, it was very difficult to track those. We weren't looking at this as you know, the market share drop. First of all, the business analysts, it was their job to track this. They were not involved in the ratings. They were not involved in the analytics. They did not know what was going on in terms of any of the rating actions that were coming. They were completely independent of that. Their job was to look at what's going on in the market and to provide information back to management and to ask the questions. So for them, no, this wouldn't have changed for them. They're doing the job that they've been doing, which is to find out what's going on in the market and to be able to explain that to our management. From my point of view, I want to know what deals are being done in the market and what type of deals are we not rating, what type of deals are we rating. We were seeing, just from the ABS CDO point of view, if there were ABS CDOs that were coming through and we were rating them or we were not rating them, then I'd like to know what is it how are we looking at these differently? And so that's important for us to know. It's important knowledge for us to know. The transactions, at least one of them that you've highlighted or that are highlighted on the previous exhibit, is a loan transaction. And we need to understand why we are not rating it. We understood that there were certain transactions, market value loan transactions, that Fitch was rating. And there was a reason why we weren't rating them, and it was because our enhancement levels were different. And so that's something, that's information for us to know. There was no negative consequence to us not rating those transactions. But it was information that we were expected to know, despite the fact that we were taking rating actions in another sector of the CDO market.
Was Mr. Polanski involved in rating CDOs?
Yes. Synthetic.
Was Mr. Kolchinski involved in rating CDOs?
Yes. When we say rating CDOs, they were responsible for the...
Did they sit on ratings committees?
They
or CDOs. Did Ms. Fu?
Yes.
Okay. And was Mr. May involved in rating of CDOs?
Yes.
And you forwarded Mr. Serrano's email to them. Is that correct?
They were on the original email as well.
And you described earlier that not rating a deal wasn't necessarily a bad thing. Mr. Serrano's email to you talks about any reason for concern, describing the drop in the deal count and the volume.
You said answer the question again.
I'll answer it again. Ask it again.
Is there any exhibit 5?
Yeah, exhibit 5.
Okay. There's no forward that I see in here. Is there one that's
looking
at?
What?
You said that there was a forwarding in here. I see only Ray Line.
Okay.
I just want to make sure I was on the right exhibit.
12:13 p.m. 10/5/2007 from Yuri Yoshizawa to Polanski, Kolchinski, Fu, and May.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
You sent that email, right?
I responded to all.
Okay. But you were responding to Mr. Polanski when you asked, can you please take a look at the deals that we didn't rate from the spreadsheet that Ivy sent out last night to double check the information and to let me know any of the stories.
Mm-hmm.
That question or that direction, you're directing that to Mr. Polanski, is that right?
To all four of the MDs.
And Mr. Kolchinski and Mrs. Fu and Mr. May, right?
Right.
Okay. And Mr. Serrano's email to you that you then respond to and direct that question to your MDs, Mr. Serrano, when he describes his email to you, he says market share by deal count dropped to 94%, though by volume it's 97%.
Mm-hmm.
It's lower than the 98%+ in prior quarters. Any reason for concern?
Mm-hmm.
The concern that Mr. Serrano is describing is the drop in deal count and the drop in volume. Is that correct?
No.
What concern is he talking about?
I don't think he's saying that we're concerned about these numbers. He's asking what's going on in the market. Is there something that's going on that we should be concerned about? Is there something going on, whether it's in terms of rating differences of opinion on certain topics? Is it because of differences in ways in which we're pricing the analysis? Are there any concerns as to, is there something out there for us to be concerned about? He's not saying that I'm concerned about this drop. At least that's the way I read it, that I'm concerned about this drop. Explain this to me.
And do you think that that's the way your managing directors interpret this email as well?
That is the way that I intended the email to. That's the way I interpreted it. That's the way I asked the question that first, can you look to see whether this is correct and let me know if there are any stories out there. So, the MDs are coming back and saying, no, there's nothing that I can see that's going on.
Mm-hmm. The month prior to this email chain from October of 2007, do you recall Eric Kolchinski coming to you with concern over the ratings of the KBS CDOs?
I don't recall a specific instance that you're talking about. We were all concerned more than a month prior to this about the ratings of ABS-CBS, so it was a common discussion among all of us that were involved with ABS-CBS.
Did in September of 2007 or thereabout, mm-hmm. did Mr. Kolchinski approach you and express concern about Moody's continuing to rate ABS-CBS without any adjustments, given the fact that rating downgrades were being contemplated?
Eric and I had multiple discussions over many months. I don't remember the specific discussion that you've had, that you're pointing to. He did raise concerns, not just with me, but with others in the group about the methodology that we're using, as well as with, at some point, he raised the concern about continuing to rate transactions. It was, I should mention when I say others in the office, I mentioned before that each MD had senior analysts that they relied upon for committees, methodology, for essentially for running that area, the sector. By this time, because we had kind of consolidated all the ABS work under Eric, and then also under Eric and Yvonne, what had developed was an ABS steering committee, is what they called it, which was comprised of Eric, Yvonne Fu, Jonathan Polanski, as well as about 10 or so senior analysts in the group who were responsible for developing methodology for rating transactions, for committing transactions, etc. The idea behind the steering committee was that it was... I'm trying to explain to you.
Appreciate it. Well, I do want to get to the steering committee, but I just want to get back to, okay. to laying out what happened and the facts. I'd asked, did Mr. Kolchinski come to you with concerns about continuing to rate ABS CDOs in and around September 2007? I think your answer was, is that yes?
Yes, I don't know the exact timing of that discussion or the specific discussion that you're referring to.
And you described his concerns as concerns about continuing to rate ABS CDOs, is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. And what was Mr. Kolchinski's concerns that he had expressed to you about continuing to rate ABS CDOs?
He was concerned his concern that he brought to me was that the methodology, well, let me sit back. His responsibility as the head of the sector was to recommend or to develop with the steering committee the methodology to rate the transactions. And what he was coming to me with a concern on was that he and his steering committee could not come to an agreement as to what the appropriate methodology would be to rate the ABS CDOs.
Did Mr. Kolchinski, mm-hmm. and we can start with everything about the background, but mm-hmm. I'm going to try to ask this as sort of a yes or no. Did Mr. Kolchinski ask you or say to you that in former substance, we need to stop rating ABS CDOs until rating actions can take place? Did he say that to you?
He has said, I don't remember the last part of it. I don't remember the until rating actions can take place.
Did he come to you at any time mm-hmm. in the fall of 2007, September 2007, thereabout, mm-hmm. and say to you, we need to stop rating ABS CDOs? And we can get to the reasons why.
Yes.
Did he say that?
Yes.
Okay. And why did he say we need to stop rating ABS CDOs? What was the reason he gave you?
He gave me the reason that he didn't believe that we could come to... He didn't think that we had an appropriate methodology to be able to rate them.
Okay. And what was your response to his suggestion to stop rating ABS CDOs?
My response was to ask him what the discussions were among the steering committee, given that their responsibility was to look at the specific issue of methodology to be able to rate or to surveil ABS CDOs.
Did you say that you would stop rating ABS CDOs?
I said that I needed to understand what the rationale was behind it, as well as to hear what the opinions were of the other MDs and other senior analysts who were involved in ABS CDOs.
There were deals in the pipeline at the time that he came to you, is that correct?
There may have been. I don't know what the specifics were.
Did you take any steps to stop the rating of any of the ABS CDOs that were in the pipeline after Mr. Polchinski approached you about his concerns?
It's not my role to stop the rating of a transaction. It's not my role to decide whether a transaction can be rated or not be rated. The action I took based upon that is to go to, is to, he stepped out of a, the instance that I can remember where he brought this up was when he stepped out of a ABS steering committee meeting to say this to me. I went back with him to the ABS steering committee meeting to ask the other MDs as well as the other senior analysts their views as to whether we were able to rate the ABS CDOs that we, the proposals that we had, do we have the ability to continue to surveil the transactions that were already existing.
Did you admonish Mr. Kolchinski for making the suggestion to you to stop rating ABS CDOs?
No.
Did you tell him that you would look into it?
This was, I immediately did look into it, which was to go to find out what was the rationale. So we had a long discussion with the steering committee, including Eric, as to what each person's views were as to whether we could or could not rate the ABS CDOs.
Who is Andy Kimball?
Andy is currently my supervisor.
And what role did Mr. Kimball have in these discussions?
He was not part of that discussion.
Did at any time Mr. Kimball talk to you about any of the concerns that Mr. Kolchinski had expressed to you?
Andy raised concerns in, I think it was 2008.
In 2007? At this time period when Mr. Kolchinski came to you about stopping the rating of ABS CDOs, mm-hmm. Did you have any conversations with Mr. Kimball about that?
Not that I'm aware of. Okay.
Do you have any conversation with Mr. Kimball about notching of Moody's own RMBS?
No. I don't remember Mr. Kimball being involved at that time.
You recall asking Mr. Kolchinski to prepare a press release concerning the notching of levels of RMBS?
Mr. Kolchinski and I worked jointly on that press release.
Okay. And did you ask Mr. Kolchinski to work with you? How did Mr. Kolchinski get involved? Did he start it on his own and you said, I'll work with you? Did you say, Mr. Kolchinski, I want you to work with me on this press release? Did someone direct you to work with Mr. Kolchinski? How did you come to work with Mr. Kolchinski on a press release concerning the notching of RMBS?
The press releases, this one I think was pretty important press release. I think you're talking about the September 21st mm-hmm. Press release. Typically, a press release that we think could garner a lot of attention would be something that is reviewed by many levels, and we work together on a daily basis. I don't remember telling him to write it. I don't remember him coming to me to ask me to help him write it. I just remember that we work together on it. His, as I mentioned before, his responsibility was to come up with the methodology that we should use to rate and surveil the transactions. The notching methodology that was developed with a combination of Eric, John Polanski, and Nicholas Vail. And I think all three had participation in the development of the press release.
Who first suggested the idea of notching?
I don't remember.
Were you involved in the, you mentioned Mr. Vail, Mr. Polanski, mm-hmm. Mr. Kolchinski. Mm-hmm. Were you involved in these discussions leading up to the notching?
In terms of the discussions about the specifics of the notching, No, I do remember a larger discussion that included myself as well as Noel Kernan, where we discussed the concept of notching. I don't know who proposed it. I don't remember if it was proposed at that meeting or it was something that was proposed earlier and we just discussed it. But I was not involved in the actual development of the notching grid.
What was the notching in layman's terms? What were you announcing on September 21st, 2007?
As I mentioned, we were trying to develop our methodology for rating and surveilling ABS CDOs, taking into account what we expected to see in terms of the rating actions on the underlying RMBS. And the question was raised as to whether we could stress the ratings that we were using in our analysis, and how can we do that? What is the methodology by which we can stress? Because we know that there is going to be further deterioration. We don't know how much for any specific asset until the actual analysis is done by the RMBS group. But we know that there will be deterioration. So then the question in terms of the methodology was, how do we, first, can we determine some level of stress that we could be comfortable with that would make us feel comfortable that we're getting to a rating that's accurate? And then secondly, how do we come to that stress? What is the methodology by which we get to that stress? The notching is essentially taking the public rating that's outstanding for any specific RMBS asset and applying a number of notches to it, and then treating it in our CDO analysis as if it's that lower rating.
And was this for prospective ratings, or was the notching applied retroactively to the deals that had been rated the week before or 2 weeks before?
It was used in both new ratings as well as surveillance of existing transactions.
So you went back and re-rated the deals that you rated the week before the notching?
So the entire surveillance sweep that we were doing incorporated this, and we looked back at every single transaction that we had rated, including those that we had rated previous to the announcement.
Does that mean you were re-rating these prior deals?
We don't re-rate. We monitor the transactions, and to the extent that we feel that the ratings need to move, then we downgrade or we upgrade or we take rating action.
And by that, did you mean that you ran the deals that you rated the week before the notching through the model again with the notching to see how the ratings came out on the other side?
We did that with our entire stock of transactions, including those that we rated the prior week.
Can we take a lunch break?
Sure.
It's 127, we'll go off record.